Picture a small town. Maybe it's in a valley somewhere, you know, cut off from the noise of the big city. It feels utopian.
Right.
And in this town, there's no cash, there are no banks, no interest rates, none of that. You bake bread, I fix cars, someone else teaches guitar. We just trade.
Using a simple ledger, it's a dream that has launched, I mean, literally thousands of community currency projects.
And here is the cold bucket of water and the hook for today's deep dive. Almost all of them crash and burn.
They do.
They start with a launch party, everyone trades for a month, maybe two, and then the whole thing just grinds to a halt. The system freezes, and everyone just goes back to using dollars.
It's a tragic pattern. But the fascinating part isn't that they fail, it's why they fail. It's rarely about a lack of, community spirit.
So it's not the people?
No.
The bad man.
Bad math. Structural engineering flaws in the accounting. Today, we are moving way beyond the hippie vibes of local currency and looking at the rigid frameworks needed to make a moneyless exchange actually work.
And we're deep diving into the work of T.H. Recco Jr. and some hard data on member performance.
Right.
So our mission today is to unpack how you build a financial system based on reciprocal exchange, giving as much as you get without political money. And spoiler alert, it involves treating a poet very differently than a grocery store.
And that's going to be the controversial part, but it is the absolute linchpin. If you treat everyone as economically equal, the system breaks.
Okay, so let's dissect the failure first. To understand the solution, we have to look at the car crash. The source material gives us a scenario, a local exchange trading system, or LTS.
Right. So let's set the stage. You've got Robert, he's a landscape painter. You've got Donald, a physicist who wants to teach guitar on the weekends.
The casual members.
The casual members, a poet, a pet sitter, you get the idea. And then, crucially, they convince two real businesses to join, a food store and a mechanic. Now, in the typical model to get things moving, the organizers give everyone a credit line, an overdraft. Let's say 200 credits for everyone to start.
The logic seems sound, right? You need liquidity. If I have 0 credits, I can't buy anything. But if I can go to -200, I can hire you today. It greases the wheels.
Correct. It kickstarts the flow. So everyone has 200 credits. The clock starts. What happens?
Well, people start spending.
But where do they spend? This is where we hit the pooling problem. I mean, think about it. Human needs aren't symmetrical. Everyone needs food. Everyone eventually needs their car fixed.
But not everyone needs a landscape painting every Tuesday.
Exactly. So Robert, Donald, the poet, they all rush to the food store and the
Mechanic.
they spend their credits. So you look at the ledger. The food store is just racking up credits. Their balance is climbing 1,000, 5,000, maybe 10,000 credits. They are rich in this currency.
And at the same time, the poet and the painter, they're sitting at their negative limit. They've spent their 200, now they're maxed out.
And to clear that debt, they need to sell something.
And here's the friction.
Is the grocery store owner going to buy 10,000 credits worth of landscape paintings?
Probably not. There's a limit to how much sunset art a grocery store needs.
Exactly. And the mechanic doesn't need 10,000 credits worth of guitar lessons. So you end up with a jam.
A liquidity trap.
That's it. The essential businesses have this massive pool of credits that they can't spend. They've pooled the currency.
And the casual members are stuck in the negative.
And the consequence is inevitable. The food store owner looks at this pile of 10,000 credits, realizes they can't pay their suppliers in dollars, they can't pay their electric bill. So they say, "Sorry, I can't accept this funny money anymore."
They drop out.
They drop out. And once the places where you can buy actual stuff leave, the currency is worthless.
But the system dies. That is the pooling problem. Established businesses find it easy to earn, hard to spend. Casual members, easy to spend, hard to earn.
And the fatal flaw was treating them as equals at the starting line.
Which brings us to the first big structural fix from Greco's work. Abandoning equality for, well, for reality. We need to talk about issuing members.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. How should credit be allocated?
So credit acts like a pump. It shouldn't be a participation trophy. Greco argues you have to distinguish between producers and consumers. And the producers, the businesses with high demand, they should be the issuing members.
Meaning they get the right to create the money.
Yes. They should be allowed to spend before they earn. They can run a significant negative balance.
Wait, hold on. Why give the businesses more ability to go into debt? That seems counterintuitive.
Because they need to pay local suppliers. They need to pay their staff. When that food store pays a local baker for bread using credits, they are issuing currency into the community. They're creating the money that everyone else will eventually earn.
And we trust them because we know their cash register is ringing all day. We know they can earn it back.
Precisely. They have high reflux, a term we'll get to. Now, you compare that to the consumers, our landscape painter. Greco suggests they should generally be required to earn before they spend.
That seems harsh. So the regular person can't go into debt at all.
Or a very, very tiny limit. Maybe 50 credits. Enough for a haircut, not enough to wreck the system. The idea is to anchor the value of the currency to real high volume production.
So we're moving from a philosophy of fairness to a philosophy of reliability.
Which is the only way to make it fair in the long run. If the currency collapses, that's unfair to everyone. And reliability, well, that relies on math.
Let's dig into that math. This is the part of the source material that really surprised me. It wasn't just the theory. There were specific formulas.
Oh, yeah. It's not a guessing game. It all centers on the sale performance ratio, or SPR.
Break that down. What is the SPR measuring?
It's the golden metric. The definition is the number of days of sales it would take for an account to clear its debit balance back to zero.
Okay, so how do you calculate that?
You take their closing debit balance, how much they owe the system,
yeah,
and you divide it by their average daily sales over, say, the last 90 days.
Let's walk through an example. Let's use Maria the baker.
Okay, so let's say Maria has a debit balance of 200 credits. She bought flour. But she sells about 25 credits worth of bread every single day.
Okay, so 200 divided by 25 is 8.
Right. Her sales performance ratio is 8. It means in the normal course of business, she clears her debt in just 8 days. That's a very healthy account, a safe bet.
Now let's go back to Robert the painter. He also owes 200 credits. He bought a lot of groceries, but he hasn't sold a painting in 3 months. His daily sales average is
0.
Zero.
And 200 divided by zero is infinity. His ratio is off the charts. His account is stagnant. He's a drag on the system because he extracted value but hasn't put any back in.
The research actually gave us benchmarks for this. What's the safe zone?
An optimal ratio is between 20 and 50 days. A healthy system-wide average is around 30 days.
And where's the red line?
If the ratio hits 100 days, that's the danger zone. It means the system has issued more credit to that person than they can realistically earn back in a reasonable time.
This connects to that other term you mentioned, reflux.
It does. Reflux is the rate at which issued credit is redeemed or, you know, destroyed by sales. Think of credit as a temporary bubble. Sales pop the bubble. Greco sets a target of a 1% daily reflux.
Meaning every day, 1% of the total debt in the system gets cleared by transactions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you clear 1% a day, logically, you clear the whole balance in 100 days. That's why the 100-day SPR is the limit. If you aren't clearing that, your system is bloating.
So if I'm running this thing and I see the reflux rate drop to, say, 0.5%, I know I have a problem.
You have a massive problem. You need to tighten the credit limits immediately.
The source material also mentioned this credit line issuing matrix from a guy in Scotland. This seemed incredibly granular.
Richard Loki. Yeah, he ran the business exchange for almost 20 years. He was ruthless about quality control. His matrix uses 11 different factors to set limits.
Like what are we looking at besides sales?
Well, the rating of your goods. Are your products actually desirable? He looked at your reputation as a buyer, your reputation as a seller, your complaint history.
So if people complain about your service, your credit limit gets cut.
Absolutely. It basically gamifies trust with real economic consequences. If you're a pillar of the community, the system trusts you with more liquidity. If you're a flake, you get zero credit.
It stops freeloaders mathematically. You don't have to shame them. The algorithm just shuts off their tap.
Exactly. It removes the politics from the decision.
So we've solved the problem of people owing too much. But I want to swing back to the other side. The food store problem. The pooling.
The idle positive balances.
If I'm the food store and I have 10,000 credits and I just sit on them, that's actually bad, isn't it?
It's terrible. It's like damming a river. Those credits are taken out of circulation. It means other people can't earn them. The water level drops for everyone else.
I've heard of demurrage as a solution for this. Basically, a tax on holding money. A negative interest rate.
Greco discusses that, but he actually argues against it, or at least says it's not the primary tool we should reach for.
Why not? It seems efficient. Just force people to spend.
He calls it a punishment. It penalizes the people who are providing the most value, the successful sellers. And generally, positive incentives work better than punishments.
So what's the carrot then?
You reintroduce the concept of savings and investment. The system creates savings accounts alongside trading accounts.
And how does that help the flow?
If the food store has excess credits, they move them to a savings account. The system's administrators then take that liquidity and loan it to entrepreneurs who need capital to expand.
So say I want to build a new bakery, I need credits for an oven, I can borrow the food store's excess credits.
Exactly. The food store holds a savings balance, and you get the capital to build the bakery. It keeps the credit moving. It turns a stagnant pool into a flowing irrigation system.
I like that image, but it introduces a new danger. What if my bakery fails?
Now we are talking about risk.
Because even with all these metrics, sometimes businesses just go bust. Who holds the bag?
This is the most critical distinction in the entire source text.
Oh.
The difference between private credit and collective credit.
The source used a used car sale to illustrate this. Let's walk through that. We have Charles. He wants to buy a car from Louise for 3,000 credits.
Right. But Charles is a regular member. He only has a 1,000 credit limit. He can't just write a check for 3,000.
Okay, so scenario one. He pays what he can.
He pays 1,000 in system credits, maxing his limit, and the other 2,000 in cash. So the system is only at risk for that 1,000 credits. If Charles leaves town, the community loses 1,000. It's manageable.
But maybe he doesn't have the cash. Scenario two, he asks the system for a bigger limit.
Now the system, meaning every single member collectively, is at risk for the full 3,000 credits. If Charles flakes, everyone takes a hit. The currency devalues. That's a huge risk.
You can't just print money for everyone who wants a car.
Exactly.
And then there's scenario three. This was the one Greco seemed to point to.
Scenario three is private credit. Louise, the seller, accepts the 1,000 system credits. But then, personally, she says to Charles, I'll let you owe me the other 2,000.
So she acts as the bank for the difference?
Right. The community's risk is capped at that standard 1,000. The other 2,000 is a private agreement between them. If Charles defaults on that, Louise loses the money. But the community's ledger stays balanced.
That feels like a vital safety valve. You can't expect the community to underwrite every risky decision.
Precisely. You have to distinguish between collective credit, what we all back together, and private credit, what you and I agree to.
But even with that collective credit, losses happen. How do we cover that?
You need a reserve fund.
Basically insurance.
Yes. It's non-negotiable. The system charges a small transaction fee on every trade, maybe 1% or 2%. That money doesn't go to profit. It goes into a reserve fund.
So when, not if, but when someone defaults, the loss is covered by the fund.
Exactly. You don't have to slash everyone else's balances. You have a buffer. It protects the integrity of the whole system.
It sounds so professional. I mean, we started this talking about a utopian exchange, but to make it work, you end up reinventing insurance funds, credit limits, risk analysis.
You do. But the difference, and it's a massive difference, is ownership. In this system, the community owns the credit. The community sets the limits. There's no external bank extracting profit from every transaction. The accounting is there to protect the community's labor.
It's not about good vibes. It's about good accounting.
A successful alternative economy requires acknowledging that a grocery store is different from a poet. It requires admitting that risk exists. It requires math.
And it really redefines wealth. I think that's the philosophical nugget to end on.
Mm.
In the regular world, wealth is the number in your bank account. It's static.
But in this system, that number is just a temporary score. A positive balance is an imbalance. It
Right.
means you've given more to society than you've taken back. Real wealth is the flow.
The ability to convert your work into the things you need. If the flow stops, the wealth vanishes.
It does.
So here's a provocative thought for you to chew on. We're all taught to view a high balance in our savings account as success. It means we're safe, we're winning.
Right.
But in the logic of reciprocal exchange, a high positive balance effectively means you have served others but haven't allowed them to serve you in return. You're holding a claim check you haven't cashed.
It's a very different way of looking at it.
So ask yourself, is that stagnant pile of money in the bank really a badge of honor? Or is it, in some strange way, a failure to reciprocate? Are you stopping the flow?
That is a question that could keep you up at night.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll see you next time.